Okay, so as the audio noted, we are recording the audio, and everybody is muted with the ability to unmute themselves. And so with that, we'll get on with tonight's deck, and I'll kick it over to Alan. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so we have, as usual, we have a bunch of information for everyone tonight. And first off, maybe you recall that last year we had a special 2-for-1 membership deal, and the board met earlier this week and we decided we would reinstitute that. But before you all get your checkbooks out, if you are already an OPCUG member, right, if you have a membership right now, we will extend your membership by an additional year. And there will be no charge for that. So please don't send us $20 as a membership renewal, because you really don't need to do that. However, if you're not a member, or if you have friends or relatives who are dying to join the computer club, if they join before March 31st next year and pay the annual membership fee one time of $20, then we will give them the year's membership that they get for their $20 and an additional 3 years membership. So for $20, new members can get essentially a 2-year full membership benefit years. So you get 2 years for the price of one. So $20 and you've got a 2-year membership in the club. So I'll come back to that later on. For now, you remember that we're always interested in having people present things like applications for Android devices and also your favorite programs for Windows. And we ask you to send us some information to the suggestion box. And a week or so ago, Tom Trottier did exactly that. He sent us this message which says, "These are the Android apps that I use daily." And then there was a whole list of apps for his Android smartphones. So we thought that was a great idea. There's so many there that we're going to make him into a special series. So we now have a series called Tom on Android. I'm going to kick off tonight. Tom, if you want to unmute yourself and talk to these slides, I picked out the three apps which are related to communications. So the first one is WhatsApp.
Daily. It's because I run a bridge club on BridgeSpace Online, and the TDs are around the globe. In fact, the bridge club I run is called Global Club, and it basically creates tournaments for anybody to be able to play. So WhatsApp Messenger, WhatsApp is really good. It's good for chatting and sending out messages. I also have the desktop version, which in fact is what I usually use. But you can also use it on your Android phone, or I suppose your iPhone as well. And it does pretty well. Even some of my TDs are in India, and I have talked to them using WhatsApp. We're using video and audio, although I do say that it's mainly chatting on text. I give notices and keep everybody up to date. You can also create groups of people. So I have a group called Global Club Tournament Directors, and whenever I want to communicate to all of them who are on WhatsApp, I actually send a message to that and it goes out to everybody. It's nice. It has it actually tells you whether the message has been received at the other end. There's a little check mark next to each message saying it's been sent. And if there's a second check mark, it means that it's actually gotten there. Doesn't mean they watched it or saw it, but it has gotten there. So you can call, message, video chat. It has end-to-end encryption, and it's run by Facebook. They own it. And when they try to actually start to monetize some of the chat by not by showing ads or anything, but rather by showing ads on Facebook that actually corresponded to stuff you put in your chat, they got taken down by the public very quickly. So it's there's no ads. It's end-to-end encryption. It's pretty fast. And the only requirement is that you be able to, that you have your existing phone number. It uses that as the way of making you unique in the world. It can also, you can create people who are connections by using the phone book you have from Google, the contacts list. Are there any questions on WhatsApp?
Signal is a private messenger,
and it's probably more trustworthy than Facebook and WhatsApp. It has end-to-end encryption, which apparently WhatsApp has actually taken over. They're using the same code to be able to manage end-to-end encryption. It's pretty fast. It can be set up as a as your chat manager instead of using your chat manager on your phone. You can have the messages go to Signal and answer them there. That doesn't give you any extra privacy, but it simplifies things by just having one place to look for messages that are coming on your phone. It's an independent nonprofit. It's supported by donations. And this is stuff that I think, I guess, Alan took from the Signal listing in the Google Play Store. And it, the source code is available so that you can check it out for yourself. Not that I have either the ability or desire to do so. Are there any questions?
Those bullet points came directly from your email.
Oh, well, I guess I copied them over then.
So there was a comment. Tristan says, the downside to WhatsApp is that all your data is then inspected by Facebook to profile you. And he says Signal has similar functionality and is privacy-focused.
Well, that's true. On the other
hand, Signal has, what, maybe a million or two users, while WhatsApp has probably several hundred million. So it's a question of, if you can get people to use Signal, then I think it's a little better. It also supports voice and video calls as well. So if you can move people over to Signal, that's good. But WhatsApp is more general. Also, by the way, on WhatsApp, you can send pictures and you can send documents of large sizes. I've gone up to 20, 30 megabytes. So that's another use for it. I don't know about Signal. I haven't tried. I don't use Signal that much. But some people I do connect using Signal. Are there any other questions?
And Jocelyn's asking, how can Facebook profile you if it's non-profit?
I think Facebook
is profit-oriented. Signal, on the other hand, is non-profit.
So this was the third one.
Yes, Google Duo. You can make calls between Android. It's similar. These are all similar in functionality. You can chat. You can text. You can have video calls. You can have voice calls. So you can have a group call with 32 people, send video and voice messages. And Google Duo is kind of the successor to Hangouts. And it's really too bad because on Hangouts, you used to be able to make a phone call anywhere in North America for free. But they've deprecated Hangouts, and now it's Google Duo, from which you cannot make phone calls to a phone, per se. You have to connect by people having Duo on the other end. So it's again, these are similar functionality, and how you, which one you use, probably depends on who you're talking to and what they have. It's also probably Google Duo doesn't make any guarantee of privacy or end-to-end encryption, so Signal and Facebook are better that way. Are there any questions?
Tim says that you get selected ads from Facebook.
I have not noticed any, but then again, I have not noticed any ads on WhatsApp. The ads I haven't, I've seen ads on Facebook when I'm on Facebook, but I don't see any ads on WhatsApp.
Okay, well, thanks, Tom. So we'll go down the list next week and see what we've got. So moving along, Chris has a session on computer basics.
Yeah, so this is all about selecting multiple files, and I'm going to go through a few slides very quickly just to show you that, and also so it's part of the record that you can download later, but then I'll do a demo of all of this as well. So one of the things about Windows File Explorer, if you click on one file to select it, you can do whatever you want. You know, you can open it, you can delete it, you can move it, copy it, whatever. If you click on another file, that other file will get selected, and the previous file gets deselected. So it's a one-at-a-time type thing. Next. So what if you want to work on multiple files at once? So if you want to delete a whole bunch of files or copy or move them or email a bunch of files or some other operation that you have that's added itself to the right-click menu in Explorer, you might want to have it operate on multiple files at once to save yourself time and trouble. It's really tedious to do it one at a time. So with where there's a will, there is a way, or with Windows, as is typical, there are multiple ways of accomplishing things in Windows. So the first one is to do a select all. So if you want to do an operation that is all of the objects at the current level, so that'll be files and folders that are at the current level, if you just press Control A, it will select all the files. And then you can do whatever you want, copy them, delete them, move them, whatever. The next thing you could do is a marquee select. Now, it's not exactly the way most marquee selects work. Most marquee selects is you click and then you drag a bounding box that surrounds the objects that you want to operate upon. In this case here, you do just draw out this bounding box, but as long as that box touches any file, it will become a selected item. So in this case, I clicked at the top right-hand corner of that blue box that you see. I held the mouse button down, I dragged it down and to the left, and then I released it when it was over top of another one, and the four images or the four files that were selected there or touched by that blue box will become selected. And then I could do whatever operation I wanted on those four. The next thing that you can do is a control key select. So a control key select will do non-contiguous selection. So they don't have to be side by side in order to be selected. So in this case, you click once on one file. So in this case, I clicked on angle of view JPEG. And then I hold down the control key and I click on an additional file. In this case, I clicked on MondayLisa.jpg. And then it selected those two files and ignored all of the other files. Now I could continue on, holding down the control key, and I could click on additional ones to select them as well. If a file is selected, for example, Monday Lisa is selected now, if I continue to hold down the control key and I click again on that, it will deselect that item. Once you have all of the files selected that you want to do an operation on, then you can continue on with whatever that operation is. The next thing that you can do is, before I leave that, there is a thing that is, go ahead, Alan, I was going to go on to a different topic. The item checkbox is one of the things that was introduced in a relatively recent version of Windows 10, and it's available on the View menu in File Explorer in the Show Hide group. There's item checkboxes. So if you check that box, then it can work like the control key. So rather than having to hold down the control key, what you can do is hover over the file until you see the checkbox, and you click on the checkbox itself, and it will act just as if you had the control key held down. Now, the control key still works, even when item checkboxes are there, but it's just another option if you want those checkboxes. Personally, I hate those checkboxes, but to each their own. So the next thing that you can actually do for different types of selection is a shift key selects. And a shift key select will do contiguous range. So you click once. In this case, I clicked on angle of view JPEG. And I changed the view on here to be a list view rather than the icon view, just because it's a little bit simpler to actually see the idea of a contiguous series of files. So I clicked on the first one, angle of view, and then I held down the shift key, and I clicked on mondaylisa.jpg, and it selected from the first click all the way to whatever I clicked on afterwards. Again, once you've done that, you can do whatever operation you want on that. And then the other way you can do is actually a control and shift combination. So in this case here, you can do contiguous and non-contiguous ranges of files. So in this case, I clicked on angle of view. And then next, I held down the control key and I clicked on lioncamera.jpg, which is a non-contiguous selection. And then I held down the shift key and I clicked on OPCUG date calculation. And in that case, it went from a contiguous range of the last click I did, Lion Camera, down to the file that I clicked on. So you can do contiguous and non-contiguous. And then you can always do control clicks and things like that too to add additional ones or take ones out of your selection. So now what we'll do is we'll actually do a demo of all of this. So I'm going to take over the sharing. And screen share and get rid of my mess. Find my file manager. There we go. There. Okay. So what we have here is just a bunch of dummy files that I put into a folder so that I can demonstrate how this all works. So the first idea was the idea that when you click on something, it selects it. And if I click on something else, it deselects the first one and selects the other one. So that's the single file select. The next one is the marquee select. So in this case here, I don't want to click on a particular file because if I click on a file and drag it, I'm going to end up moving it or copying it or something else like that. So what I have to do is click on an area where the highlighting doesn't go, and then I can drag a marquee select. And you can see as I touch another file area, it'll select that particular file. I can go over here, select that one. I can go down, select those. I can go across, select those four. When I release the mouse button, all those fours will be selected. And then I could right-click on them. I could, you know, resize pictures. I could cut them to move them to another location, copy them, delete them, rename them, whatever I wanted to do that is available on that shortcut menu. So that's doing the marquee select. Next one is the control select. So if I just click off, and so nothing is selected at all, and then I click on one, and then I can hold down the control key, and I can click on any other ones I want, and they will become selected. If I decided, oh, I really didn't want to have mondaylisa in that group, I can control click on it again, and it becomes deselected. Okay? So once you've got all of the ones that you want, then you do whatever operation it is that you really want to do. Now, the item checkboxes, got control panels here in my way, so let's go to the view menu and choose item checkboxes. And now, oops, let me just that. Sorry, I'm just moving Zoom controls out of my way. So now as I hover over files, I get that little checkbox up in the left-hand corner. So I can click on that checkbox to select it. And if I wanted to, and I'm not holding down the control key, and I can click on that one, and it is as if I held down the control key. Now, you have to do it right on that checkbox. So if I come down here and I say, oh, I want to add that, and I just click where I am right now, it deselects the other ones. This is as if I just did without item checkboxes. So you really have to aim for that little checkbox if you want to use those. You can just ignore them. So again, I can do a control click, control click, control click, you know, and that works as normal. Shift select. I'll show you on here how a contiguous range, it's a little bit confusing to look at, because what is a contiguous range? If I choose this folder, and then I click down on this file with the shift key, it will select a contiguous range from that first one to the one that I click on, which will include that one, and that one. So if I do shift click, I end up with that contiguous range going. I think contiguous ranges and that are a little bit easier to see and understand when you're in a different view. So I'm actually going to go onto the view, and I'm going to say I want to go to a details view. And now it'll be a little bit easier to understand that idea of contiguous range. Oops, sorry. Why is it not sticking? There we go. Okay, so if I just click off somewhere, they're all deselected. And so now if I click on one file and then I come down here and I hold down the shift key, it'll select from my last click to what I click on while holding down the shift key. Then if I decide I don't want some of those, I could do a control click to deselect ones, or I could do a control click to select additional ones, or I could do things like a contiguous range and then hold down, for example, the control key or click on the checkbox. And then I could hold down the control and shift, and that will choose, because I did the shift, it'll do that contiguous range from my last click to what I click on with the shift key held down. So all of those are different methods that you can use to do multi-file select and then do some operation that is on all of the files at once. So any questions on using multi-file selects in File Manager?
Tom had a comment. He says, don't forget sorting and views. Well, you've shown some of the views. I imagine by sorting, he means if you click on one of the titles, they sort in order.
Yeah. So, I mean, in your details view, you can select, you can sort by date. Or type any tag that you have up there. And if you want some additional tags, you can right-click on here, and you can actually select additional fields that will show up. So, for example, because I've got images in here that have EXIF information, I could do 35 millimeter focal length, and then that would, well, in this case, none of them have that information in there. So I could deselect that one. What's something else I could do? Date taken, is that in there? Okay, so some of the photos actually have embedded information about the actual date that the photograph was taken in addition to the other information. So you can add additional tags or take them away, and then, yes, you can sort them by anything by just clicking on the header.
If you have any date directories, you're best not to use anything that's not kept in the directory listing. For example, size, type, date, and name are all in the directory, but tags and dimensions and other stuff, the operating system has to go off and fetch that from each and every file. So if you have 1,000 or 2,000 files in the directory, it's going to take a while to actually bring up all the information for those files if you have those extra columns added to your directory.
Windows does track this information by folder. So if you change the view in one particular folder to add, for example, dimensions or something like that for images, if you go to another folder, it won't be there by default. You have to turn it on, and then it'll track it if you do change it in another folder as well. I think there is a way that you can change what the default is, but it's been a long, long time since I played around with that.
There's one quite useful feature in that details view, Chris, and that's just to the left of name, there's a checkbox.
Oh, yeah.
It's essentially select all or deselect all. That can be really handy.
Yeah. Yeah, so it, rather than going at them individually, if you do want to do a select all, Control-A will do it for you. So if I just hit Control-A, they'll all be selected. But that checkbox will do that same thing, toggle between a select all and a deselect all. Okay, if there are no other questions,
I think they answered that about how to change the default. If you select view and then option, then you can change the folder default.
Oh, really? Okay, that's new. I never look at where is it? Oh.
Yeah, option.
Yeah, I'm probably having things open up off screen or something on me, but
yeah, if you click on, then you will see that change the default for folders.
Okay. Yeah. Right now, I've got such a cramped screen that I don't know where that's opening up for me. So
I saw it for a second.
Oh, actually, yeah. Okay. So, well, yeah. Okay. I think rather than me stumbling around on things, people can play with that on their own. Unless there's something else that I can demo, I think we'll call it done and move on. Any other questions? Okay, going, gone. There we go. Back to you, Alan.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Well, if anybody does have any questions, drop it into chat or send Chris an email and we'll deal with it later on. Okay, it's time for me to get into the act, and I just want to go back to my moving from Windows 10 to possibly full-time Linux. And if you remember, those of you who have been here before, we've been going through this list of Windows things, which I use quite a lot, and trying to figure out how I can do them in Linux. And last time we talked about using an HTML editor, and I showed how to use Wine, which is a kind of an emulator, if you like, for Windows programs. So I can run the home site program, which is a Windows application, in the Linux operating system. So now I want to go back to this problem I had with Microsoft Excel, and in particular with trying to do macro programming. So let's call this segment Excel Revisited. And I'll just remind you that I've got a whole bunch of spreadsheets that use VBA macros, Visual Basic for Applications. So if I click on this control button here, it's running a macro in the background, which is looking up these file names on a web server and generating hyperlinks over here. The problem is when I try and run that in Linux, and you can see here I'm trying to run this in LibreOffice Basic, I basically get runtime errors in the Basic program. So the problem was I was using this evaluate function, and I said previously that there are ways around that, different techniques that you can use to program. I can get around that. However, having Wine available is actually quite useful. Because if you look up on the application database, you'll find that various versions of Excel will run under Linux, and some of them are platinum, which means they're excellent. To gold, to silver, to bronze, to some don't seem to work very well at all. Well, it happens that I own Microsoft Office 2007, which they say is bronze. So some of it should run at least. And in addition, just instead of using Wine, I just want to make everybody aware that there's another application called Play on Linux, which is a kind of a front end for Wine. It makes things a bit easier to deal with. And so when you install Wine, when you install Play on Linux, in Linux, and you run it, then you get this install the program window here. And when you click on that, you'll find that it's gone out to the web, and it's found a whole bunch of applications that it knows how to deal with. And they're all grouped by things like games and graphics. And this one right here is called Office. So if I open that up, then you can see I can deal with things like Evolution, which is an email program. But there's all kinds of Microsoft products here, including Microsoft Office 2007. So if I tell Play on Linux I want to install Microsoft Office 2007, it will say, well, put your CD in or your media disk, and basically off you go, install it. So now you can see that I have successfully installed Microsoft Office 2007 in Linux by using this Wine front end. So here's Play on Linux, and here's my three favorite applications, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. And when I install them, you can see that in the main, this is a Linux desktop. Here's the menu. Here's the Office category. And you can see, in addition to having LibreOffice, I now have Microsoft Office products available to me. So sure enough, if I run Word and open a .dot file, you can see here's a newsletter article with titles and italics and text and hyperlinks and typical kind of Word document opened in Word in Linux. And here's a PowerPoint file, which you should recognize. It's a Q&A session from a few weeks back. And again, you can see we've got the individual thumbnails and we've got the slide in the main window available to be edited. And then finally, the one I really want to deal with is here's Microsoft Excel. And it's running my spreadsheet here with the Create Hyperlinks control button and the VBA macro in the back end. And so I click on that macro, and it basically says that it finished the processing, but it couldn't find a hyperlink for this particular file over here. Well, I happen to know that the hyperlink should be created because that file does exist. So one of the things you can do in VBA is open up a second window in Excel, which shows you the various VBA modules. And I'm looking through my module here that's behind that control button, and I get down to this function here, which is does the URL exist or not? And it's trying to say it's true or false. So we come down here, and it basically blows up at this line right here, which says it's gone out to find the status of this hyperlink request, and it's set the results counter to be the status, and it's got it to be okay with this square symbol on the back end. But if you look at the next line down or so, you will see that my command is, if RC is equal to okay, then the URL is true. Well, it doesn't equal okay because Linux in its wisdom decided to include this non-printing character in here. So the result is actually okay and this little square box, which is not okay. So that ain't going to work. And that's what's wrong. That's why it failed. But I can get around that really easily by just changing my test. And so I've commented out if RC equals okay. And now I say, if there's a substring okay inside the results counter, then that's okay. So it will find okay with a square bracket because it's only looking for the substring okay. So I had to change my VBA code a little bit to run in Linux. But now you'll find that with that new code, it completes successfully. So if I go back to my main program and pick up my four test files here, click on the Create Hyperlinks button, then they all complete successfully. So now I'm actually running Excel, a Microsoft application, in Wine, in Linux, and it's working correctly. So now, as far as I'm concerned, I can add the big green check mark next to Microsoft Excel. And now we're in the home stretch, as it were. We've got two or three more things to take a look at. Okay, moving along into the questions that people sent in. Iqbal wants to know how to prevent hacking. Is there any software available? Will Bell Canada help him? He's already been hacked once, and do we have any suggestions? And Chris has got a whole pile of suggestions.
Yeah, so to first tackle the question about the ISP protecting you, personally, I don't think that's the ISP's job at all. The ISP's job is to provide you with a connection to the internet and transport your traffic. That's it, full stop. Now, a lot of ISPs will do additional things, but I don't count on it. Two weeks ago, I talked about some things that I found in my Rogers Ignite thing that could add additional capabilities to the router for monitoring and blocking traffic. I think that's great, but I don't look at that as a replacement for what I do to protect my network. I look at it as, well, maybe it'll give me some additional protections. So while your ISP may give you some capabilities or do some things on your behalf to protect your connection, I certainly don't count on it. And they are very opaque about what they do and don't do with their traffic and so forth. So you never really know what they're doing anyhow. So I think it's your job to protect your computer. And so it's really up to you. So we have talked extensively about computer security at the user group. So one resource we have is the Fraud Watch page. If you go to our homepage, there's a button at the top for Fraud Watch, and it has a lot of good information on there, links to other resources, as well as examples of fraud attempts or whatever that have happened and what you can do to guard yourself against it. So there's a lot of very good resources there about security from that perspective. At OPCUG main meetings, if you go to the link that you see there, past presentations, we've had things just last month, or earlier this month. Tom gave a great presentation on security layers and all the different things that you can implement on your computer to help protect your privacy security. Windows Firewall Control was talked about again by Tom at the Members' Favorite on September. I gave a presentation on keeping passwords safe, so how you can prevent identity theft or accounts being compromised by virtue of the fact that you have good password hygiene. Scam Avoidance and Trust is a presentation that Lawrence has given on how to protect yourself against online scams and what you should be watching for. Alan and I have given presentations on effective backup strategies. So although it doesn't prevent a bad thing from happening, it allows you to recover if a bad thing does happen on your computer so that you can get your files back and that sort of thing. Multi-factor authentication is a presentation that Lawrence gave on, again, how to protect your accounts by making them more resilient to attack. And he also gave one on password phrasing. So a lot of presentations that we give at the main meetings have revolved around various aspects of security. So you can check out the past presentations link, check that out, and keep an eye out for the future. I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. In the newsletter, there's lots of articles that have been in the newsletters about computer security. So just check out that link, browse through the topics, and you'll find lots of information on how to protect your computer. Q&A, we've talked about it a lot at Q&A over the last couple of years. You know, you can go to that link, which gives a list of all of our topics over the last several years, and, you know, look for things that have topics that mention security, backup, antivirus, AV, control folder access, protection, security audits, updating, ransomware, and so forth. So if you just look through the topics there, you'll find that there's a lot of information that is available on security-related topics. And if you have any questions beyond what you find there, bring them to Q&A. You know, and say, well, I don't think we've covered this. Well, you know, can we talk about this aspect of security? And, you know, we're always open to new topics for sure. So the main security measures as I see them, when it comes down to how to protect your computer, you need antivirus, the built-in Microsoft Defender. Is, I think, perfectly adequate. It's all I use for AV on my computers. You need a firewall, the firewall that is built into Windows since Windows XP SP3 or SP2. There was a built-in firewall for blocking inbound intrusions. It is perfectly adequate. If you want outbound protection as well, there are some solutions around that go beyond what you can easily do with just the Windows firewall. Keep your software up to date from a security point of view. So don't try to defeat anything that wants to do auto-updating. Certainly Windows is difficult to prevent it from auto-updating, and I don't suggest that anybody should. All your other third-party software that you have on your computer, a lot of it now will allow for auto-updating, or if you go to the Help About menu, there might be an update option, or worst-case scenario, periodically check with the vendor's website to see if there are security updates that are available. And if it's just pure security updates, generally speaking, they'll be available free of charge. Anti-spyware, which is really an extension of antivirus, but it has a little bit of a different flavor to it. Identity management. So that's that idea of your password protection. You know, so protect your passwords. How do you prevent them from being compromised? And then backup. Very, very important for when the other things fail, this allows you to recover. So I think if you pay attention to those six items and give them all their due, the likelihood of you running into security problems on your computer are really quite low. So that's all I have to say. If anybody else wanted to chime in on things, Tristan notes opening mail from unknown senders, one of the most common ways for hackers to get in. Yes. But in reality, you really hope that your other layers of defense will cover you as well, but certainly a lot of brand new malware gets distributed quite quickly through email. So yeah, attachments in particular in email, be cautious about those. Tom says don't click on links in mail. Always a good thing to avoid getting taken to a site that is going to try to compromise your computer. John noted auto update bricked my wife's laptop when she was traveling in Vietnam, and the bus is leaving. My thought to anybody who says that Windows update is evil and needs to be avoided, I say, well, yeah, bad things have happened with Windows update for sure. Bad updates have gone out and done horrible things to people's computers. They are in the minority. Would you rather have Microsoft make changes to your computer where they presumably are trying to do as good a job as they can to make sure that your computer is still functional? Or would you rather have a hacker make changes to your computer because of some piece of software that you didn't update that had a security vulnerability? Because the hacker will happily do it and won't care about your computer.
And it depends how bricked is too. If it's really bricked and you can't turn it up, power it on, then it's a problem. But and if it's just a question of Windows won't boot, if you have a portable USB drive and a backup program, then you should be able to do a recovery on the spot.
Yeah. And Microsoft as well is very good. If you have security issues of any sort, if you call for support to Microsoft, it will be a free call. And my experience with their support has always been that it is very good.
So Tom had put a YouTube link in recommending Kaspersky, but he says personally he uses Windows Security. He talks about Windows Firewall Control, making inbound or outbound control easy. And Tristan had noted, Chris, your preference for a password manager. Have different strong and long passwords for every site, and where available, use two-factor authentication.
Yeah, and I've talked about those. In the ones where I talked about password protection, I mentioned two-factor authentication. I haven't really strongly advocated it as much as I've strongly advocated how to create strong passwords and then protect them with a password manager. I use KeePass. It's been around for a long time. It's very actively updated frequently with new features and things like that. So it's got a huge community going on it. And I've been quite happy with it. It's available for ports of it are available for Android as well. So I have the same password database on my desktop and my laptops and my phone and all synchronized through Google Drive. So it's one view to my passwords from any of my devices, which is nice. I see Tom says, how do you call MS for support? If you check out my article I wrote on getting help from Microsoft, if you have any Windows computer, you can go to Get Help. And if you, they'll ask you, what are your problems? And if you just keep on saying, no, that doesn't answer my question, that doesn't answer my question, that doesn't answer my question, eventually they will put you through to talk to a live person. And you can do it through either an online chat, or you can have a callback where they will actually phone you if you're, you know, when they're, whenever the queues ease up, they will actually phone you back and deal with you on the phone. So that I find is the easiest way to actually get access to Microsoft, because you can do it from any Windows computer. You can just go to the Get Help and it'll go through to it.
I was going to add to that, Chris. I hope everybody understands how the chat system works on Zoom. It's really Zooming tonight.
Yes.
Tom had put that, how do you call MS for support? And almost instantly, Tristan put a link in for global customer service phone numbers.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, yeah, Microsoft doesn't make it obvious on their website how you can phone them. They really want you to use the online features. They want you to use their answer forum and community forums and things like that. But it is possible to actually talk to Microsoft. And as I say, if you identify it as being a security issue, it is guaranteed to be a free call. If it's something non-security, they might try to charge you, but I've never had them actually try to charge me.
Tom says long password is 20 plus characters. Do you have any comment on that?
That is a long password, yes. Do you need 20 characters? Personally, at this point in time, I don't think it's an absolute. Personally, I think that 15 or more is very good. I have an article that is going to be, I'm just finishing it up and getting it in, so it'll probably be published in a couple of months on password security. And I talk there about NIST recommendations as well as some ways that you can check on strength of password and ways not to check the strength of password, because there are some sites that do a horrible job of determining whether password is secure or not. Steve Gibson's How Big Is Your Haystack, or How Big Is My Haystack, is a really, really good webpage resource on talking about password strength. And he has some really, really good advice in that. So if people are interested in checking that out, I'll get it and paste that into the chat window as well.
And Jocelyn says, the best Microsoft support, Google. And Lawrence has pasted an interesting link. Lawrence, I know you want to speak to this. And it's a link for Try Not to Be Dave.
Sure. Whoever has control, just go to the Know Before site and then post it on your screen. It's one of my favorite cartoons. And it's very succinct.
Is it coming up on mine?
Well, you're sharing, so.
There it is. Now, does anyone want to...
Chris's pre-meeting deck.
Now, does anyone want to guess when this cartoon was written?
Oh, probably 20 years ago.
not quite, but 2006.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, security hasn't really fundamentally changed what you need to do to protect your computer. I've been giving how to secure your computer presentations. I have given it about 35 times at the, or actually closer to 50, I think, times at the Ottawa Public Library, and some tweaks. But other than that, it's fundamentally, it hasn't changed. So.
Okay. Well, let's
and anybody who wants to, anybody who wants to look at it, I just pasted in the Gibson Research how big is your haystack link in there, so you can check out that article if you're interested.
Okay, so we're going to move along to a kind of related topic. We had a question, and there's lots of information on the web on VPNs, and everybody that's selling one says it's the best. So the question was, who here is using one? Which one do you use? What do you use it for? And essentially, would you recommend it? So this was a question that was posted in the Cubs members only forum. And the response that came back was basically from Bob Walker. And Bob, I'll let you talk to your thoughts on this.
Okay. The next couple of slides are basically my answer, direct answer to the questions that were asked. And since then, we've had a bit of email back and forth exchange. And so we'll cover those additional issues next week. But I've used NordVPN with good results. And if you look online at all sorts of different reviews of different VPNs, NordVPN is always in the top five and is often the number one choice. But the same can be said for ExpressVPN, which is also highly rated. And these two seem to be the 1-2 choice in most of the reviews. A couple of years ago, I switched to Avast SecureLine VPN, and because it came free with the Avast Ultimate package, and Avast now calls this Avast One, but it's basically their antivirus and VPN and a bunch of other tools all thrown in with licenses for five devices for not much more than you pay for just the basic antivirus paid for version. So, however, I find the Avast VPN to be a bit flaky, and so I'm going to switch back to NordVPN. The Nord licenses and as well the Express VPN licenses, they have Christmas special deals right now, and most of their licensing deals are good for five or six computers. So you're not having to kick in and buy a separate license for each computer you have. Okay. I use a VPN pretty much whenever I'm on the internet, and in my case, this is mostly for privacy reasons. If you have a reasonably well-secured home network, a VPN isn't going to do a lot for your security. However, where a VPN is very good for security, if you're using a public Wi-Fi like at Tim Hortons or at Starbucks, or if you're in a hospital or at your dealer's service department waiting for your car to be fixed, you really want to have a VPN because it encrypts all your data and information. And this might be an issue as well if you live in a high-density apartment building and you can see 20 other different Wi-Fi networks on your computer. You might want a VPN for security for that, but it's more of a privacy tool otherwise. As Tom noted at his great presentation he did last week, you need your security in layers, and a VPN is an extra layer. Again, not so much for security, but for privacy. I occasionally use a VPN for accessing internet services that are not available in Canada. And they call this geo-hopping or a couple other similar terms. And basically, if you have a Netflix account, you can look, you can access the much better programming on Netflix USA by using a VPN to appear like you're in Chicago. Some of the different services can detect that you're using a VPN to geo-hop and won't allow it. And some, like Netflix, don't seem to care that much. I find that I've had some issues with bandwidth on Zoom, and even tonight I've had a lot of pop-ups saying your internet connection is unstable. So it's one of my ways of sorting this out right now. I disconnect from the VPN when I'm on Zoom, but I have a feeling that my Zoom problems have a lot to do with other issues as well, so I'm going to start investigating these a bit further. And I'm looking forward to seeing if this is an issue when I switch back to NordVPN, which I'll probably do in the next few days. Now there's just a note here that some websites don't work properly with a VPN. I've had problems with Costco, Loblaws, Home Depot, and a few others. Costco seems to be okay now. But I either have to shut off my VPN to access these sites or just don't bother. I've also come across a couple of sites that detected I was using a VPN, and they basically said, turn it off if I want to connect, because they want to be able to track what I'm doing. with a VPN, because, you know, you're appearing to always come from somewhere else other than exactly where you are. If you're not using a VPN and a site asks to know your location, it'll basically show where you're at within a few kilometers. It'll show that, let's say you're in Ottawa, or in my case, they always show that I'm in Merrickville. But if you're using a VPN, by default, the Avast SecureLine VPN, I have it set to show that I'm in Toronto. It used to show that I was in Montreal, but I changed that. But if a site asks to know your location, and whatever, the VPN will give them wrong info. Though some sites seem to be able to detect this, your proper location anyway.
Yeah, Bob Sergeric says for an unstable connection with the VPN, he sometimes changes servers, and that solves the problem.
One caution I'll point out that some people have problems with VPNs is that there's some places like Gmail and things like that, that if you all of a sudden change that rather than in Ottawa, you're now all of a sudden coming from Paris, they may at least temporarily block you, because they'll say, you know, they think, well, this is not reasonable. It must be a hack. And banks will also do this. So if you log on to your bank coming from your normal IP address, and then you switch on a VPN, and all of a sudden you're coming from Chicago, they could block access to your account based on the idea that, well, you're in 20 minutes, you didn't go from Ottawa to Chicago, that sort of idea. So just be a little bit careful about some sites for that.
Yeah. Well, next week I'll talk about a couple of the other issues that we passed back and forth by email with VPNs, and possibly the week after I can cover how various sites can bypass the VPN location services to know that it's really you. There's about four or five techniques that they have for doing this, and I'll talk about that at that point in time.
So does anybody else have any VPNs that they would recommend or not recommend? Serge Eric, again, is asking, does anybody have any thoughts on Windscribe? That's what he's using with his NVIDIA Shield television system and home computers.
Yeah. Just Natalie, a note here, I mentioned earlier, but Natalie also pointed out in the chat there that NordVPN has a Christmas special. It's about half price, and ExpressVPN has a similar Christmas special. So now would be a good time to get a license if you're looking to get one. And both of them will let you try free for I think it's a 1 month period. Try it before you buy it, type of thing.
Serge Eric is saying with Bitdefender VPN, it's quite flexible, and you can turn off the VPN for specific websites that you choose. Natalie says Nord's VPN special is $79 for the first 2 years, $3.29 US per month. Timothy says he uses the one that comes with McAfee. And Natalie says that's 72% off the price. So if you have any other thoughts about VPNs, clearly Bob's going to do some follow-ups over the next couple of times. So send them along to suggestion box and we'll make sure Bob gets the information. And our final question that came in was to do with compressing PDF files. And I think John...
Yeah, John's on...
talk to his problem.
Yes, basically I'm following up Alan's talk on Linux, but going the other way, I gave a talk about compressing PDFs. And I have an interest in having some Windows users use it because U of Ottawa, where I get a lot of my email from correspondents, actually blocks anything above about 12 megabytes now coming in. It seems to, I don't know if it's doing it or it's just got a bug, but anyway, it means that large stuff doesn't come through. And quite often I found it very useful when I'm putting stuff on the web to shrink stuff down. And it's fairly well known how to do this using GhostScript. There's a lot of fancy parameters in the call, so I put it into a script. And that was fine. And then I actually did some work on it in Linux, and I actually tried compressing a whole directory tree looking for the PDFs. And out of 4,500 files, I found 38 had errors that came up. In fact, the resulting files were unreadable. And so I put in, I thought, well, I'll just check the return code like Alan did with the OK. And in Linux, it's supposed to be zero if you've got a good result and non-zero if you haven't. But GhostScript actually showed in the log file that it had errors, but it returned zero. So that was not good. So I found a way to trap the errors. It was kind of messy, and I can do it in Linux. And I thought it would be really nice to get that script beyond the GhostScript part, which works fine in Windows. I've got that running. But I don't really do PowerShell. And so I thought I'd ask if there's anybody who does some sort of scripting in Windows willing to work with me to get it running in Windows too. And this works in my machines by right-clicking and choosing compress PDF, much as Chris was talking about in the file manager, right-clicking after you've selected files and doing something. So I thought this might be useful to get things cross-platform. It's always nice to have it cross-platform, and then people can move around between machines, and it's not all suddenly, oh, I can't do that, because it's a different kind of... It's like cars in the year 1900 where they all had to be driven differently. And we don't want that anymore. We're going beyond that now. The different operating systems have different features, and that's fine. But for the user, normal user, it should be easy. So this is that's my question anyway. And there's my email, we should have got that. It's just nashjc@ncf.ca. The PDFs shouldn't be part of that email. I'll put it on here.
My apologies.
No, I'll just put it in to everybody here. I'll send everybody my email. It's
we'll change it in the deck that goes up on the web.
You could also look me up in the Telfer School and go to that email if you want, nashjc@uottawa.ca. They all come to me through Thunderbird anyway, but NCF is the shorter one. So that's it. It's really just a query. If someone's interested in this, I'd love to work with them, and we'll get it set up so it works.
That's great, John. Thanks very much.
What kind of compression do you get, John, on your PDFs?
What's that?
What kind of compression rate do you get?
I think on the previous slide, there's a link to the Linux Ottawa site where I actually have about a 10-page article showing some experiences, and it varies very much with the type of PDFs. And in some, it actually goes the wrong way. And the script detects that. I've got factors of up to 20.
Wow.
20-fold compression. Now, I also give some examples showing that this depends on the parameters to GhostScript, and sometimes you can go too far and it then looks fuzzy. But the one I've chosen is actually remarkably good on sort of hundreds of files, it's really quite adequate for the things I want. It is a lossy compression, but it's quite, what I found was that things like I'm on checking something and I want to buy something, but I don't want to buy it now. I want to sort of keep something for a record later, and I'm on Amazon. So I do Control P and get a print to PDF. And those seem to be about something like half a megabyte sometimes, when they can compress down quite happily to 50K.
Wow.
And really, I don't want a whole lot of half megabyte files around when really these are just, they're scribble notes really for future use and eventually discarded. Or I'm doing stuff where I want to keep sort of essentially thumbnails of art of documents, but I still want them readable. They don't have to be archive quality.
Okay, well, various things like that. So John's real address is in the last thing in the chat window right now. And as I say, we will correct those slides. So when you download it from the web, you'll have his email address. And if you're interested in power scripting. So we're about 5 minutes over the hour. I think we'll skip the other questions and go to the wrap up. And I just want to remind any non-members in the club that you can get 2 years for the small price of $20. And it's a great Christmas present for your grandchild or whatever. Well, your grandchild probably knows more about computers than we do.
Or for your neighbor who's always bugging you to solve their problems. Tell them to, they can join and learn from the group.
So if you go to this join or renew link, you'll find this advert there, and that will give you the option of actually joining by PayPal. So next week, we have another Q&A session. That will be Wednesday, December 22nd. And as usual, if you have questions, answers, or topics that you'd like to share, programs that you'd like to share, send us an email to our suggestion box address. So that's it for tonight, and we hope to see you next week.
Thanks very much, folks. See you next week.
Right.